Have you gotten as far as Jesus is now? His ministry is well underway, and people are following him. In fact, so many people following him, he has trouble finding time for himself. And then we read, "When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake. Then a teacher of the law came to him and said, 'Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go.' Jesus replied, 'Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head.' Another disciple said to him, 'Lord, first let me go and bury my father.' But Jesus told him, 'Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead.' Then he got into the boat and his disciples followed him. Without warning, a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat, but Jesus was sleeping. The disciples went and woke him, saying, 'Lord, save us, we're going to drown.' He replied, 'You of little faith, why are you so afraid?' Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, 'What kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him.' And when he arrived at the other side in the region of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men coming from the tombs met him. They were so violent that no one could pass that way. 'What do you want with us, Son of God?' they shouted. 'Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time?' Some distance from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding. The demons begged Jesus, 'If you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs.' He said to them, 'Go.' So they came out and went into the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and died in the water. Those tending the pigs ran off, went into the town and reported all this, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. Then the whole town went out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they pleaded with him to leave their region." Kind of this whole chapter is, in a sense, isn't it, about authority, but it's also about conflict and confrontation. We've seen in the Gospel of Matthew that Jesus survived an assassination attempt when he was only a few days or a few weeks old, and there's authority here. There's pressure. There's power. And Jesus seems to be always at the center of a storm. And he still is. This is a cartoon I dug off the internet about the Big Brother diary room. It's day 60 and Chardonnay, you love the name, don't you? It's day 50 and Chardonnay has been called to the diary room. And she says, the introduction of Jesus into the house has really divided the group. Most of us think he's cool, but some of the group look like they could kill him. I can see it doesn't work for some of you. I think that's very clever. Jesus in the Big Brother house, what would happen? That's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yeah, right, try that in an essay. They are creative writers among you. Try that. Jesus in the Big Brother house. Thank you. Thank you, Roshni. If you follow Jesus, you can expect something of the same. You know, I spend my life inviting people to become committed Christians. I mean, you know, that's what I do. And I say, you know, what do I say? Jesus gives you peace. Jesus gives you salvation. Jesus gives you a purpose in life. Jesus affirms you as a person. Jesus cleanses you and changes you. But really, what I can't say is people are going to love you for becoming a Christian, because they're not. Really, they're not. And those of us who are of a certain age when people tend not to notice what we are, what we think, it's okay. But younger people really struggle with that at school. And some of you will be nodding, at school, it's really tough to be a Christian. It can be hard at university. There's pressure on you, you know? And I have to say to people, you know, if you become a Christian, that's great. But, you know, don't expect people to thank you for it. And we see it all the time. We see pressure put on people, often from their parents. Young people get a lot of pressure on them from their parents. when they become Christians. They seem to think, you know, if they go and do something terrible, their family will stand by them. If they become a Christian, then the family criticizes. Strange, isn't it? The inverted values of our world. And people kind of give up, drop away because of it. This is a word from the late John Stott, greatly missed. He writes this, he writes beautifully. He says, "The Christian landscape is strewn with the wreckage of derelict, half-built towers, the ruins of those who began to build and were unable to finish. For thousands of people still ignore Christ's warning and undertake to follow him without first pausing to reflect on the cost of doing so. The result is a great scandal of Christendom today, so-called nominal Christianity. In countries to which Christian civilization has spread, large numbers of people have covered themselves with a decent but thin veneer of Christianity. They have allowed themselves to become somewhat involved, enough to be respectable, but not enough to be uncomfortable. Their religion is a great soft cushion. It protects them from the hard unpleasantness of life, while changing its place and shape to suit their conveniences. No wonder the cynics speak of hypocrites in the church and dismiss religion as escapism." So we come to Jesus. If we put verses 19 to 22 up on the screen, Jesus is about to sort of set off across the lake, and a number of hopefuls come up to him, and they talk about following him. And the first is a teacher, though. He comes and he says, "Teacher," in the original, that's "Rabbi, Rabbi. I will follow you wherever you go." And the rabbis, ancient rabbis, they were very picky about who would they allow to follow them, in fact. You had to sort of apprentice yourself, you had to candidate yourself to be a disciple of a rabbi in those days. And you, once they took you on, you had to follow them everywhere. The ancient people at that time talked about being covered in your rabbi's dust. In other words, you had to walk so close to him that the dust kicked up from his sandals, settled on you, and then you were a true disciple. When you followed the guy everywhere, seeing what he was doing and following his teaching. And so the teacher of the law comes to Jesus, and he says, "Rabbi, I'll be your disciple. I'll get covered in your dust." That's kind of what he's saying. "I'll follow you wherever you go. I'll be your disciple." But Jesus really is not convinced. Especially if you remember, he's just about to head off into the teeth of a storm on the lake. So he says, "Look, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Maybe the guy was just, he'd follow Jesus everywhere as long as it had a nice comfortable bed. Every evening to have a sleep in and a nice breakfast and a restaurant attached for the snacks and so on. You know, just wanted an easy life. And Jesus said, "Look, you know, you're going to follow me. You don't know where you're going to go." I have sympathy with that. Susan and I lived in 19 different houses in the first 23 years of our marriage. That was the missionary life for you. So I have huge sympathy with the saying of Jesus. And, you know, to Susan and I, Jesus could have said the same thing. You know, if only follow me if you're prepared to live in a different house every year or two. What would you say? You have to say, "Well, yeah, I still will." But this guy didn't, apparently. No sign of him afterwards. Presumably, he thought, well, maybe not. And so the next one says, so the first one he says, you know, face the facts, you know, move, it's time to move on. But the guy really didn't want to move on that much. And then the second one, it's hurry up. The guy says, "Let me first go and bury my father." It doesn't make much sense in our culture. And the way it's written, it's a bit confusing. And if you're new to the Christian faith, new to the Bible, you might look at that and think, "What on earth is he talking about? Let me go and bury my father." Actually, we don't know what he was talking about. There are two possibilities. One is he could be saying, "I'll come and follow you once my father has died. Once my father has died, then I will receive my share of the inheritance and I can set things up and I can set off and follow you." That is one possibility. So he's just waiting till his father's gone, so he doesn't need anyone's permission and he doesn't get any conflicts. That's possible one explanation. The other is, say when somebody died, they were placed in the tomb, but they weren't properly buried until a year later. And a year later, when the body was decomposed, the bones were taken and put in a little urn, and that was buried. And that was kind of a year later, that was considered the burial. So it could be that his father has died, but he's just got this space of mourning, a year's mourning, and then his father will be buried properly. He can follow Jesus. It's one of those two, probably, that he's talking about. And Jesus said, there isn't time. There isn't time. If you're going to follow me, follow me today. Follow me today. Don't leave it till later. We've lost the urgency a bit, haven't we, I think. In my when I was at university, I had the privilege of living through a revival. It was called the Jesus Revolution, and it was wonderful. And in our Christian Union University, the Spirit of God fell during one prayer meeting. Actually, had a half night of prayer, and the Spirit of God just fell on people. People lying on the floor, people crying, people just being moved by the Spirit. In fact, everyone got up and went into the student union and sang a hymn. Actually, they couldn't contain themselves. That was what was just in our university. That started in California and it spread throughout Western Europe. And there were young people everywhere becoming Christians and being filled with the Spirit of God. And at the time, it was a wonderful time of expectation, but there was a sense of urgency about it. What I remember most was the sense of urgency. Many believed that Jesus was about to return, and just urgency to get on and go out and do things. And a good number of those became Christian missionaries, and I was one of them, I should know. But there was that sense of urgency, and I just go, for all the things I miss, it's that sense of urgency. Yeah, I can live that most things, but the kind of thing, we'll get around to a mission eventually. But Jesus said, no, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. Hurry up. There's a sense of urgency here. And then Jesus moves on to face the storm. It's a case of standing up and facing the storm. I thought I'd show you a picture of the Sea of Galilee. Here it is. It's 8 miles across and 13 miles long. And that, I'm assured, by the internet, by Google, is the Sea of Galilee. And it looks very nice, but it looks kind of big. And I have to say, would you fancy being in the middle of that in a little rowing boat in a force 8 wind? And I think your answer, like mine, is I would give that one a miss. I did actually try to, this afternoon, I did have a search to find a storm on the Sea of Galilee, but I couldn't find one. Either that's because it doesn't look great, nobody bothers taking a picture of it, or because they're so in common, there's nobody there with a camera when it does happen. I don't know. In the ancient world, some of the travel writers commented it was known for its severe storms because the mountains funnel the wind. And it could suddenly throw up a storm in no time at all. And so it was calm when they set out, but let's have verses 23 to 27 on the screen. It's the next slide. And there we go. And Jesus saw the crowd around him. He gave orders to cross the other side of the lake. Then he got into the boat and his disciples followed him. And without warning, a furious storm came up on the lake. So sounds to be pretty unusual, but it was pretty violent. Don't forget that the people traveling in the boat with Jesus were professional fishermen who were out on that lake every day. And they knew when they were in trouble and when they weren't. And they knew they were in trouble. No doubt about it. They were frightened. And if they were frightened, it was because they were in very real danger. Do you want to discover how much faith you've got? Face a storm. Get a P45 delivered to you to discover how much faith you've got. There's nothing like sharpening your faith when you've got a P45 in hand and the prospect of unemployment. discover a suspicious lump on your body, that focuses your faith very efficiently. Oh, you know, I can go on forever like this, can't I? Get a phone call in the night, your heart thumps. These are things that focus our faith. These are storms. Happened to be a physical storm the disciples sailed straight into. But you and I, you know, we can just set out today and sail straight into a storm of one kind or another. And you want to know how little faith you've got? Face that. And suddenly discover how little your faith is. But listen, Jesus will not lead you or me into a storm that together we can't handle. Remember that. However the storm, we can handle it. Whatever is frightening you at the moment, you and Jesus together, you can handle it. But there is that sense which when we follow Jesus, we don't know what we're going to face. Jesus is showing his disciples, you know. Jesus had just said, look, if you're going to follow me, guys, you've got to be really dedicated. You've got to be really urgent. And they're saying, yeah, yeah, bring it on. Yeah, we'll follow you, Jesus. Yeah, we'll follow you. They get into the boat. 5 minutes later, they're screaming, Lord, save us. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't know if, have you heard of Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Some of you have, some of you haven't. He was a Christian leader who stood up to Hitler, one of the few who had the courage to stand up to the Nazi movement. And he was a minister, and he was imprisoned, and he was executed in 1945. But he wrote out of this experience when he was in prison, and on his way to prison, he wrote some stunning literature. And he wrote this once: the cross is laid on every Christian. As we embark upon discipleship, we surrender ourselves to Christ in union with his death. We give over our lives to death. The cross is not the terrible end to an otherwise God-fearing and happy life, but it meets us at the beginning of our communion with Christ. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. We'd have to make it politically correct, gender neutral today. When Christ calls a person, he bids them come and die. But it's still the same. Still a truth there. God calls us. And Jesus says, listen, who's in control? We're in the middle of a storm, facing death. Who's in control here? In life and death, who's in charge? Who's the authority here? And then if there's any doubt lingering, he stands up and he rebukes the storm and it stops. Now do you know who's in control? Remember that all those disciples in the boat but one died a violent death eventually. But they died in faith. They died with courage. They were a million miles from the scared fishermen in the boat that night. They learnt that Jesus is in control. They had to learn. They had to learn. But they did. And finally, we face the consequences. Verses 28 to 34. Jesus arrives in the region of the Gadarenes. This was the area on the east bank of Galilee in Jordan. And it was a Gentile region, although a good number of Jews did live there. And Matthew tells us there were two men. We only hear about one in the other Gospels. Demon-possessed and violent. Out of control and violent because of the power, demonic power within them. The local people were scared of them. And they were only approached in numbers to subdue them and quell them. And when they weren't chained up, you just walked the other way. You went a long way round. You didn't go near them. And what do you want with the Son of God, they shouted. That was a giveaway, of course. Jesus knew he wasn't dealing with mental illness here. There was a spiritual perception that only demon-possessed people would possess. So he knew what he was dealing with. Have you come to torture us before the appointed time? He knew he wasn't talking face to face with humans. There was demonic presence here. And so he confronts the demonic powers. And again, we find this confrontation, this authority of Jesus in question. A friend of mine, one of my colleagues in Brazil, told me the story. This happened a long, long time ago. He's now retired, but he was new to Brazil, and he was out in a congregation, and they were ministering to in church. This girl had come into the church, and she her whole family had been involved in occult activities, and this whole family had actively invited demonic powers into their lives. And this girl was sitting there, and she was saying things that, you know, just she couldn't possibly have known. And at one point, a man entered the church behind her through the door. She immediately said something about him, that she knew who he was, and some secret things about him that very few people knew. And there's something terrible going on. And one of the deacons commanded the spirit to come out by the blood of Jesus. And he was sitting there, he had a jacket on, a pencil in his pocket. So she said, as he said that, she said, "What about this blood?" And she suddenly snatched a pencil out of his pocket and aimed it at his heart. Fortunately, he had a New Testament in his shirt pocket, and it went straight into the New Testament. And so they got the pencil off her and continued to pray, and she was delivered, and she was okay. And after that, everything settled down. But there are moments, you know, when there's a tremendous conflict of authority, and it's the authority of Jesus that prevails. And the demons say, "If you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs." And Jesus says, "Go." He doesn't actually say, "Go into the herd of pigs." Actually, I only noticed that when I was reading it this afternoon in preparation, going through the sermon again. He doesn't actually say, "Go into the pigs." He says, "Go," and they apparently went into the pigs. And the pigs then sort of go off the cliff and die. Unpredictable, you wouldn't have known that was going to happen. And it frightened the local people half to death. Not to mention the loss of the pigs, and the insurance claim for that would be quite interesting, wouldn't it? And so they ask Jesus to leave. You know, and there's times as Christians we're asked to leave. And Jesus left. He doesn't insist on staying. And at times, you know, it's not like a Jehovah's Witness banging on your door, refusing to leave you alone, you know? Jesus doesn't do that kind of thing. They say, "Go," and he goes. He never chases people. He gives us the choice to follow him or not. And, you know, if you're a follower of Jesus, sometimes you're going to be asked to leave, and you have to respect that. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're going to have to respect sometimes people don't want you to talk to them about Jesus. Got to respect it. Jesus did. Why shouldn't we? Doesn't diminish his authority. Doesn't diminish his power. It's a reminder of the awful power of free will that God has given us to listen or not, to follow or not, to believe or not. So after the kind of, it struck me that after the healing campaign in Galilee, it all goes wrong, really, doesn't it? At one point, you've got all these people being healed and fantastic things. The next moment, you've got people coming to Jesus, pretending to follow, not really meaning it. You've got them nearly drowning in the middle of the Sea of Galilee at night. And then he gets sent out of the area of the Gadarenes. He gets escorted to the border by the immigration office or whatever, you know what I mean? It all seems to go wrong. It's blessings and storms. And that's the pattern. I think sometimes we read the New Testament as if, you know, he's born and it's all lovely with all the angels and the fluffy animals, and we get all gooey and sentimental about it. And then we think it was all wonderful until he gets crucified, you know. But until then, it was just an easy living. It wasn't, actually. It was conflict, it was difficulty, it was problems. It was very like our own lives, actually. But through it all, his authority shines through. through. It shines through. He is in control. And I don't know what you're going to face. I don't know what I'm going to face this year. But I know this, that whatever the storm, Jesus has authority over life and he has authority over death. And we have to accept that. Sometimes death might appear too soon to us. Sometimes he saves us from death. And there's nothing wrong in crying out to Jesus in the middle of a storm. It's not lack of faith to cry out to Jesus to help you in a storm. Just remember who is in control. Once you've given your life to Jesus, once I've given my life to Jesus, then he is in control of our lives. And our lives might not go down the road we want or we plan. But at the end of that road is Jesus waiting for us. And he walks with us all the way till we get there. So, that is Jesus, the one who